Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Massini. Tonight, Tom Bacon continues his reading from Old Times on the Mississippi by Mark Twain.
Chapter 4 is titled A Daring Deed. When I returned to the pilot house, St. Louis was gone, and I was lost. Here was a piece of river which was all down in my book, but I could make neither head nor tail of it. You understand, it was turned around. I had seen it when coming upstream, but I had never faced about to see how it looked when it was behind me. My heart broke again, for it was plain that I had got to learn this troublesome river both ways. The pilot house was full of pilots going down to look at the river. What's called the upper river, the 200 miles between St. Louis and Cairo, where the Ohio comes in, was low, and the Mississippi changes its channel so constantly that the pilots used to always find it necessary to run down to Cairo to take a fresh look when their boats were due to lie in port a week, that is, when the water was at a low stage. A deal of this looking at the river was done by poor fellows who seldom had a berth, and whose only hope of getting one lay in their being always freshly posted and therefore ready to drop into the shoes of some reputable pilot for a single trip on account of such a pilot's sudden illness or some other necessity. And a good many of them constantly ran up and down inspecting the river, not because they ever really hoped to get a berth, but because, they being guests of the boat, it was cheaper to look at the river than stay ashore and pay board. In time, these fellows grew dainty in their tastes and only infested boats that had an established reputation for setting good tables. All visiting pilots were useful, for they were always ready and willing, winter or summer, night or day, to go out into the yawl and help buoy the channel or assist the boat's pilot in any way they could. They were likewise welcome because all pilots are tireless talkers when gathered together. And as they talk only about the river, they are always understood and always interesting. Your true pilot cares nothing about anything on earth but the river, and his pride in his occupation surpasses the pride of kings. We had a fine company of these river inspectors along this trip. There were 8 or 10, and there was an abundance of room for them in our great pilot house. 2 or 3 of them wore polished silk hats, elaborate shirt fronts, diamond breastpins, kid gloves, and patent leather boots. They were choice in their English, and they bore themselves with a dignity proper to men of solid means and prodigious reputation as pilots. The others were more or less loosely clad, and wore upon their heads tall felt cones that were suggestive of the days of the Commonwealth. I was a cipher in this august company, and felt subdued, not to say torpid. I was not even of sufficient consequence to assist at the wheel when it was necessary to put the tiller down hard in a hurry. The guests that stood nearest did that when the occasion required, and this was pretty much all the time because of the crookedness of the channel and the scant water. I stood in a corner, and of the talk I listened to took the hope all out of me. One visitor said to another, "Jim, how'd you run Plum Point coming up?" "Well, it was night there, and I ran it the way one of the boys on the Diana told me. Started out about 50 yards above the woodpile on the false point, and held on the cabin under Plum Point till I raised the reef, quarter less twain, then straightened up for the middle bar till I got well abreast the old one-limb cottonwood in the mend, then got my stern on the cottonwood and head on the low place above the point, and came through a boomin', 9 and a half. Pretty square crossing, ain't it?" "Yeah, but the upper bar's working down fast." Another pilot spoke up and said, "I had better water than that, and I ran it lower down. Started out from the false point, Mark Twain, raised the second reef abreast the big snag in the bend, and had a quarter less twain." One of the gorgeous ones remarked, "I don't want to find fault with your leadsman, but that's a good deal of water for Plum Point, seems to me." There was an approving nod all around as this quiet snub dropped on the boaster and settled him. And so they went on talking. Meantime, the thing running through my mind was, "Now if my ears hear aright, I have not only got to get the names of all the towns and islands and bends and so on by heart, but I must even get up a warm personal acquaintanceship with every old snag and one-limbed cottonwood and obscure woodpile that ornaments the banks of this river for 1,200 miles. And more than that, I must actually know where these things are in the dark, unless these guests are gifted with eyes that can pierce through 2 miles of solid blackness. I wish the pilot business was in Jericho, and I had never thought of it." At dusk, Mr. Bixby tapped the big bell 3 times, the signal to land, and the captain emerged from his drawing room in the forward end of the Texas and looked up inquiringly. Mr. Bixby said, "We'll lay up here all night, Captain." "Very well, sir." That was all. The boat came to shore and was tied up for the night. It seemed to me a fine thing that the pilot could do as he pleased without asking so grand a captain's permission. I took my supper and went immediately to bed, discouraged by my day's observations and experience. My late voyage's notebooking was but a confusion of meaningless names. It had tangled me up in a knot every time I had looked in it in the daytime. I now hoped for a respite and sleep, but no, it reveled all through my head till sunrise again, a frantic and tireless nightmare. Next morning I felt pretty rusty and low-spirited. We went booming along, taking a good many chances, for we were anxious to get out of the river, as getting out to Cairo was called, before night should overtake us. But Mr. Bixby's partner, the other pilot, presently grounded the boat, and we lost so much time getting her off that it was plain the darkness would overtake us a good long way above the mouth. This was a great misfortune, especially to certain of our visiting pilots, whose boats would have to wait for their return no matter how long that might be. And it sobered the pilot house talk a good deal. Coming upstream, pilots didn't mind low water or any kind of darkness. Nothing stopped them but fog. But downstream work was different. The boat was nearly too helpless with a stiff current pushing behind her, so it was not customary to run downstream at night in low water. There seemed to be one small hope, however. If we could get through the intricate and dangerous Hat Island crossing before night, we could venture the rest, for we'd have plainer sailing and better water. But it would be insanity to attempt Hat Island at night. So there was a good deal of looking at watches all the rest of the day and a constant ciphering upon the speed we were making. Hat Island was the eternal subject. Sometimes hope was high, and sometimes we were delayed in a bad crossing, and down it went again. For hours, all hands lay under the burden of this suppressed excitement. It was even communicated to me, and I got to feeling so solicitous about Hat Island, and under such an awful pressure of responsibility, that I wished I might have 5 minutes on shore just to draw a good, full, relieving breath and start all over again. We were standing no regular watches. Each of our pilots ran such portions of the river as he had run when coming upstream, because of his greater familiarity with it, but both remained in the pilot house constantly. An hour before sunset, Mr. Bixby took the wheel and Mr. W. stepped aside. For the next 30 minutes, every man held his watch in his hand and was restless, silent, and uneasy. At last somebody said with a doomful sigh, "Well, yonder's Hat Island, and we can't make it." All the watches closed with a snap. Everybody sighed and muttered something about its being too bad, too bad. Ah, if we could only have had got here a half hour sooner. The place was thick with the atmosphere of disappointment. Some started to go out, but they loitered, hearing no bell tap to land. The sun dipped behind the horizon. The boat went on. Inquiring looks passed from one guest to another. The one who had his hand on the doorknob and had turned it waited, and then presently took away his hand and let the knob turn back again. We bore steadily down upon the bend. More looks were exchanged, and nods of surprised admiration, but no words. Insensibly, the men drew together behind Mr. Bixby as the sky darkened and one or two dim stars came out. The dead silence and sense of waiting became oppressive. Mr. Bixby pulled the cord, and two deep mellow notes from the big bell floated off on the night, then a pause, and then one more note was struck. The watchman's voice followed from the hurricane deck, "Labbord lead there! Starboard lead!" The cries of the leadsmen began to rise out of the distance and were gruffly repeated by the word passers on the hurricane deck. "Mark three! Mark three! Quarter less three! Half twain! Quarter twain! Mark twain! Quarter less!" Mr. Bixby pulled two bell ropes and was answered by faint jinglings far below in the engine room, and our speed slackened. The steam began to whistle through the gauge cocks. The cries of the leadsmen went on, and it was a weird sound, always in the night. Every pilot in the lot was watching now with fixed eyes and talking under his breath. Nobody was calm and easy but Mr. Bixby. He would put the wheel down and stand on a spoke, and as the steamer swung into her, utterly invisible marks, for we seemed to be in the midst of a wide and gloomy sea, he would meet and fasten her there. Out of the murmur of half-audible talk, one caught a coherent sentence now and then, such as, "There, she's over the first reef, all right." Another pause, another subdued voice. "Her stern's coming down just exactly right, by George. Now she's in the marks. Over she goes." Someone else muttered, "Oh, it was done beautiful, beautiful." Now the engines were stopped altogether, and we drifted with the currents. Not that I could see the boat drift, for I could not, the stars being all gone by this time. This drifting was the dismalest work. It held one's heart still. Presently I discovered a blacker gloom than was that which surrounded us. It was the head of the island. We were closing right down upon it. We entered its deeper shadow, and so imminent seemed the peril that I was likely to suffocate, and I had the strongest impulse to do something, anything, to save the vessel. But still Mr. Bixby stood by his wheel, silent, intent as a cat, and all the pilots stood shoulder to shoulder at his back. "She'll not make it," somebody whispered. The water grew shoaler and shoaler by the leadsman's cries till it was down to 8 1/2, 8 feet, 8 feet, 7 end. Mr. Bixby said warningly through his speaking tube to the engineer, "Stand by now." "Aye, aye, sir." 7 1/2, 7 feet, 6 end. We touched bottom. Instantly, Mr. Bixby set a lot of bells ringing, shouted through the tubes, "Now, let her have it, every ounce you've got." Then to his partner, "Put her down hard. Snatch her, snatch her." The boat rasped and ground her way through the sand, hung upon the apex of disaster a single tremendous instant, and then over she went. And such a shout as went up at Mr. Bixby's back never loosened the roof of a pilot house before. There was no more trouble after that. Mr. Bixby was a hero that night, and it was some little time, too, before his exploit ceased to be talked about by rivermen. Fully to realize the marvelous precision required in laying that great steamer in her marks in that murky waste of water, one should know that not only must she pick her intricate way through snags and blind reefs and then shave the head of the island so closely as to brush the overhanging foliage with her stern, but at one place she must pass almost within arm's reach of a sunken and invisible wreck that would snatch the hull timbers from under her if she should strike it and destroy $250,000 worth of steamboat and cargo in 5 minutes and maybe 150 human lives in the bargain. The last remark I heard that night was a compliment to Mr. Bixby, uttered in soliloquy and with unction by one of our guests. He said, "By the shadow of death, but he's a lightning pilot." This chapter in Old Times on the Mississippi is called Perplexing Lessons. At the end of what seemed a tedious while, I had managed to pack my head full of islands, towns, bars, points, and bends, and a curiously inanimate mass of lumber it was, too. However, inasmuch as I could shut my eyes and reel off a good long string of these names without leaving out more than about 10 miles of river in every 50, I began to feel that I could take a boat down to New Orleans if I could make her skip those little gaps. But of course my complacency could hardly get start enough to lift my nose a trifle into the air before Mr. Bixby would think of something to fetch it down again. One day he turned on me suddenly with a settler. "What's the shape of Walnut Bend?" He might as well have asked me my grandmother's opinion of protoplasm. I reflected respectfully and then said I didn't know if it had any particular shape. My gunpowdery chief went off with a bang, of course, and then went on loading and firing until he was out of adjectives. I had learned a long time ago that he only carried just so many rounds of ammunition and was sure to subside into a very placable and even remorseful old smoothbore just as soon as they were all gone. That word "old" is merely affectionate. He was not more than 34. I waited. By and by he said, "My boy, you've got to know the shape of the river perfectly. It's all there is left to steer by on a very dark night. Everything else is blotted out and gone. But mind you, it hasn't the same shape on the night it has in the daytime." "How on earth am I ever going to learn it, then?" "How do you follow the hall at home in the dark? Because you know the shape of it. You can't see it." "Do you mean to say that I've got to know all the million trifling variations of shape and the banks of this interminable river, as well as I know the shape of the front hall at home? On my honor, you've got to know them better than any man ever did know the shapes of the halls in his own house. I wish I was dead. Now, I don't want to discourage you, but, well, pile it on me. I might as well have it now as another time. You see, this has got to be learned. There just isn't any getting around it. A clear starlight night throws such heavy shadows that if you didn't know the shape of a shore perfectly, you'd claw away from every bunch of timber because you'd see the black shadow of it, take it for a solid cape. And you see, you would be getting scared to death every 15 minutes by the watch. You'd be 50 yards from shore all the time when you ought to be within 50 feet of it. You can't see a snag in one of those shadows, but you know exactly where it is, and the shape of the river tells you when you're coming to it. Then there's your pitch-dark night. The river is a very different shape on a pitch-dark night from what it is on a starlight night. All shores seem to be straight lines then, and mighty dim ones, too. And you'd run them for straight lines, only you know better. You boldly drive your boat right into what seems to be a solid straight wall, you knowing very well that in reality there's a curve there, and that wall falls back and makes way for you. Then there's your gray mist. You take a night when there's one of them grisly, drizzly, gray mists, and then there isn't any particular shape to a shore. A gray mist would tangle the head of the oldest man that ever lived. Well, then, different kinds of moonlight change the shape of the river in different ways. You see, oh, please don't say any more. Have I got to learn the shape of the river according to all these 500,000 different ways? If I tried to carry all that cargo in my head, it would make me stoop-shouldered. No, you only learn the shape of the river, and you learn it with such absolute certainty that you can always steer by the shape that's in your head, and never mind the one that's before your eyes. Very well, I'll try it, but after I've learned it, can I depend on it? Will it keep the same form and not go fooling around? Before Mr. Bixby could answer, Mr. W. came in to take the watch, and he said, "Bixby, you'll have to look out for President's Island and all that country clear up away above Old Hen and Chickens. The banks are caving and the shape of the shore is changing like everything. Why, you wouldn't know the point above 40. You can go up inside that old sycamore snag now." So that question was answered. Here were leagues of shore-changing shape. My spirits were down in the mud again. Two things seemed pretty apparent to me. One was that in order to be a pilot, a man had got to learn more than any one man ought to be allowed to know. And the other was that he must learn it all over again in a different way every 24 hours. That night we had the watch till 12. Now, it was an ancient river custom for the two pilots to chat a bit when the watch changed, while the relieving pilot put on his gloves and lit his cigar. His partner, the retiring pilot, would say something like this: "I judge the upper bar's making down a little at Hale's Point. Had quarter twain with a lower lead and mark twain with the other. Yeah, I thought it was making down a little bit last trip. Meet any boats? Met one abreast the head of 21, but she was away over hugging the bar, and I couldn't make her out entirely. I took her for the sunny south. Hadn't any skylight forward of the chimneys." And so on. And as the relieving pilot took the wheel, his partner would mention that we were in such and such a bend and say that we were abreast of such and such a man's woodyard plantation. This was courtesy. I suppose it was necessity. But Mr. W. came on watch a full 12 minutes late on this particular night, a tremendous breach of etiquette. In fact, it is the unpardonable sin among pilots. So Mr. Bixby gave him no greeting whatever, but simply surrendered the wheel and marched out of the pilot house without a word. I was appalled. It was a villainous night for blackness. We were in a particularly wide and blind part of the river where there was no shape or substance to anything, and it seemed incredible that Mr. Bixby should have left that poor fellow to kill the boat trying to find out where he was. But I resolved that I'd stand by him anyway. He should find that he was not wholly friendless. So I stood around and waited to be asked where we were, but Mr. W. plunged on serenely through the solid firmament of black cats that stood for an atmosphere and never opened his mouth. "Here's a proud devil," thought I. "Here's a limb of Satan that would rather send us all to destruction than put himself under obligations to me because I'm not yet one of the salt of the earth and privileged to snub captains and lord it over everything dead and alive in a steamboat. I presently climbed up on the bench. I didn't think it was safe to go to sleep while this lunatic was on watch. However, I must have gone to sleep in the course of time, because the next thing I was aware of was the fact that day was breaking. Mr. W. was gone and Mr. Bixby at the wheel again. So it was 4 o'clock and all well, but me. I felt like a skinful of dry bones and all of them trying to ache up at once. Mr. Bixby asked me what I was staying up there for. I confessed that it was to do Mr. W. a benevolence, tell him where he was. It took 5 minutes for the entire preposterousness of the whole thing to filter into Mr. Bixby's system, and then I judge it nearly filled him up to the chin, because he paid me a compliment, but not much of one either. He said, "Well, taking you by and large, you do seem to be more different kinds of an ass than any creature I ever saw before. What did you suppose he wanted to know for?" I said I thought it might be a convenience to him. "Convenience? Damnation, didn't I tell you a man's got to know the river the night the same as he'd know his own front hall? Well, I can follow a front hall in the dark if I know it is the front hall, but suppose you set me down in the middle of it in the dark and not tell me which hall it is. How am I to know?" "Well, you've got to on the river." "All right, then I'm glad I never said anything to Mr. W." "I should say so. Why, it'd have slammed you through the window and utterly ruined $100 worth of window sash and stuff." I was glad this damage had been saved, for it would have made me unpopular with the owners. They always hated anybody who had the name of being careless and injuring things. I went to work now to learn the shape of the river and all the eluding, ungraspable objects that I ever tried to get mine or hands on. That was the chief. I would fasten my eyes upon a sharp wooden point that projected far into the river some miles ahead of me, and go to laboriously photographing its shape upon my brain. And just as I was beginning to succeed to my satisfaction, would draw up toward it, and the exasperating thing would melt away and fold back into the bank. If there had been a conspicuous dead tree standing upon the very point of the cape, I would find that tree inconspicuously merged into the general forest and occupying the middle of a straight shore when I got abreast of it. No prominent hill would stick to its shape long enough for me to make up my mind what its form really was, but it was as dissolving and changeful as if it had been a mountain of butter in the hottest corner of the tropics. Nothing ever had the same shape when I was coming downstream that it had borne when I went up. I mentioned these little difficulties to Mr. Bixby. He said, "That's the very main virtue of the thing. If the shapes didn't change every 3 seconds, they wouldn't be of any use. Take this place where we are now, for instance. As long as that hill over yonder is only one hill, I can boom right along the way I'm going, but the moment it splits at the top and forms a V, I know I've got to scratch to starboard in a hurry or I'll bang this boat's brains out against a rock. And then, the moment one of the prongs of the V swings behind the other, I've got to waltz to larboard again, or I'll have a misunderstanding with a snag that would snatch the keelson out of the steamboat as neat as if it were a sliver in your hand. If that hill didn't change its shape on bad nights, there'd be an awful steamboat graveyard around here inside of a year." It was plain that I had got to learn the shape of the river in all the different ways that could be thought of. Upside down, wrong end first, inside out, fore and aft, thwart ships, and then know what to do on gray nights when it hadn't any shape at all. So I set about it. In the course of time, I began to get the best of this knotty lesson, and my self-complacency moved to the front once more. Mr. Bixby was all fixed and ready to start it to the rear again. He opened up on me after this fashion. "How much water do we have in the middle crossing at Hole in the Wall trip before last?" I considered this an outrage. I said, "Every trip, down and up, the leadsmen are singing through that tangled place for 3/4 of an hour on a stretch. How do you reckon I can remember such a mess as that?" "My boy, you've got to remember it. You've got to remember the exact spot and the exact marks the boat lay in when we had the shoalest water in every one of the 500 shoal places between St. Louis and New Orleans. And you mustn't get the shoal soundings and marks of one trip mixed up with the shoal soundings and marks of another either, for they're not often twice alike. You must keep them separate." When I came to myself again, I said, When I get so that I can do that, I'll be able to raise the dead. Then I won't have to pilot a steamboat to make a living. I want to retire from this business. I want a slush bucket and a brush. I'm fit only for a roustabout. I haven't got brains enough to be a pilot, and if I had, I wouldn't have the strength enough to carry them around unless I went on crutches. Now drop that. When I say I'll learn a man the river, I mean it. And you can depend on it. I'll learn him or kill him. I've been reading from Mark Twain's Old Times on the Mississippi, his account of becoming a river pilot and the profession's arcane language from which he took his pen name. The Bookshelf is a production of KPBX in Spokane. Vern Windham, executive producer. I'm Tom Bacon.